Okay. Dr. Slaman, could you present the BCRG data?
Thank you. I'd like to thank you for the invitation to participate with you in this meeting, and Neil for organizing it for us all, and thank you, Ed, for your kind remarks. But a number of people were involved in the development of Herceptin who were advocating for the program, who kept this program alive through thick and thin, that really allowed Herceptin to go on through the early clinical development to the final clinical development in the adjuvant setting that has brought us all here for this particular session. The results are indeed stunning, and they are cause for celebration for all of us, and you all should feel very good about what you've done in terms of making the adjuvant trials happen for the joint analysis, both you and the people in the NCCTG. So the BCRG trial is a randomized phase 3 trial. It started close to 2 years after the NSAVP trial and about a year after the intergroup trial. It enrolled its first patient, I believe, in April of 2001 and completed enrollment within 37 months. And it was comparing the standard arm of AC followed by T, but here the taxane was docetaxel, versus the same arm that is in the two trials that have gotten you the results that you've seen, versus a non-anthracycline-containing arm, TCH, where a platinum salt was substituted, and it's a non-anthracycline-containing regimen. It was to enroll both HER2-positive, node-positive, and node-negative disease. The HER2 positivity, parenthetically, was restricted to FISH positivity from the get-go in this trial, based on some of the data that this test seems to be much more robust in really identifying women who do, and equally importantly, who do not have this alteration. So I was asked to present the cardiac data from 006, but when this meeting was planned, we didn't know the results of the first interim efficacy analysis of the BCRG-006, which was completed on September 9th by the IDMC. And the IDMC, I think, is ably led by Dr. Sandra Swain, one of your own, who has done a remarkable job at taking a very big data set and keeping everybody on target and on pace to make sure that we get the analyses out on time. What I can tell you, and all I can tell you regarding the efficacy part of the 006 study, is that we were told and were provided information that both experimental arms crossed the boundary for efficacy, both AC followed by TH as well as the TCH regimen. We put in the press release the risk reduction seen on the two arms at this point in time. The risk reduction for the ACTH arm was 0.51, interestingly enough, almost overlapping completely with what you're seeing in your own studies. The risk reduction for the TCH arm was 0.39. So we can say at this point that both have crossed their efficacy boundaries. We've been told by the statisticians that there is no statistically significant difference between the two experimental arms, and in the press release, you have the confidence intervals that say that they're virtually, at this point, overlapping. We will be watching very closely. There will be another planned interim analysis, and I should say that this interim analysis was a planned interim analysis initially designed by protocol. There'll be another planned interim analysis at 450 events. We anticipate, although we can't guarantee, we anticipate that that should occur sometime in the middle of the first quarter of next year. So it's not far away. And we'll have, I believe, more robust numbers. But that's all I can say about efficacy at this point, other than we will present all of the data at San Antonio this year. Now, as it relates to sort of how we got there in cardiac, this drug, as you remember, was registered in September 1998 based on a registration trial done in first-line metastatic disease where the primary endpoint was to look at time to disease progression. This was a kinder and gentler time at the FDA. And safety. And then the secondary endpoints were overall response rates, duration, time to treatment failure, and survival. The thing that I think got everybody's attention at the time was the safety data. The drug was shown to be very, very safe, very few adverse events, mostly infusion-related symptoms that many of you have seen and know how to manage, generally occurring with the first infusion, and then a decreased incidence with subsequent infusions. And it's usually easily handled. So serious adverse events were infrequent, with the sole exception of a significant increase in cardiac dysfunction, particularly when this was administered simultaneously with anthracycline-based therapy. Now, none of the models told us that this would occur, and this obviously speaks to the reason for continuing to do very careful safety analysis when you do your larger studies. But remember, the antibody is directed against the human receptor, and it does not cross-react with the mouse receptor. Plus, we have not figured out good ways of asking mice if they're short of breath. But the reality was we saw none of this in the early phase one and phase two studies, and the models didn't show any evidence of cardiac problems. However, when we did the registration study in these 460 women, we began to get patients who were coming in complaining of congestive failure. And when we looked at this in a safety way, it was shown that that was occurring more in the Sercepton anthracycline arm. How bad was this problem? There are 9 events in the AC alone arm, or 7% of the population, which is right on target for what you see in the literature with regards to cardiac dysfunction with anthracycline-containing regimens at the doses we use, versus 27%, or a 4-fold increase in cardiac dysfunction. Half of that was clinical, class 3 and class 4. Moreover, we saw this in the Taxol arm, which made many people begin to say Herceptin must be the cardiotoxin, because you're seeing it when you're not using anthracycline. But if you remember the protocol design, by definition, almost all of these patients have had prior anthracycline therapy. That's how they got in to the Taxol arm. And the median time for their prior anthracycline exposure was 20.3 months. So there was some distance from the time they got their anthracycline to the time we were seeing this. This difference of 2 events or 1% versus 11 or 12% was also statistically significant. So the one thing that made us think that possibly it wasn't the Herceptin that was a cardiotoxin was a trial that was done simultaneously that a number of you may have participated in, we did, that Chuck Vogel led, for women who refused chemotherapy and were permitted to receive Herceptin alone. In that group of 152 women, the incidence of cardiac dysfunction was 2%. None of it was clinical. So we were not seeing anywhere near what we're seeing in the trial that got the drug registered. So the conclusion is that the drug provided substantial benefit, improving response rates, response duration, time to progression, and most importantly, survival when used in a first-line setting. But the real future of the drug was in the adjuvant setting, where all of our laboratory data indicate that we may have our greatest impact by using it early, as well as other potential combinations based on some of the information you've seen, as well as some of the preclinical information showing that there are interactions that could be beneficially exploited using some other drugs. So that brings us to where we're at with the adjuvant trials being reported today. You've heard the remarkable and stunning data from your own studies. I will give you the updated information on the 006 cardiac data because that is the data we have as of December 31st, 2004. So right at the beginning of this year, at the end of last year. The three arms are, as you know, AC followed by T taxotere versus AC followed by TH, again, taxotere is the taxane, versus TCH, where carboplatin is the platinum salt that's in here. The difference in administration is the Herceptin is administered right up front in the TCH regimen because we are not so much concerned, based on phase two data that I don't have time to get into today, with any increased incidence of cardiac dysfunction when it's used in this regimen. So the data we're presenting is fairly robust in terms of completeness of the data. And there are very few outstanding queries on those 3,222 patients. Potential cardiac risk factors are balanced between the studies. This was very carefully looked at and shown to be pretty well balanced. With regards to ischemia and infarction, it's fairly well balanced. With arrhythmias, again, fairly well balanced. The big difference came with grade 3-4 cardiac dysfunction, New York class 3-4, where the patients are having symptoms. There was one patient in the ACT arm, 17 patients in the ACTH arm, and one patient in the TCH arm. But basically, these are the differences we're seeing in cardiac dysfunction, class 3-4. What if we're looking at any kind of cardiac dysfunction? Well, the clinically significant cardiac events is defined by the 006 protocol. And remember, we had a broader definition, including the arrhythmias. It was 1.2% versus 2.3% versus 1.2% in the three arms, respectively. There is something very interesting here. I think all of you might note that the global cardiac dysfunction seen in 006 was less, even though we had a broader definition in the ACTH arm than was seen in the intergroup trial and in the NSABP trial. Something to think about why that is. It is not due to numbers. We have robust numbers in all these trials. I believe this is a real phenomenon. The only difference is the taxane. The conclusions for the cardiac analysis are that these are not final. We will have updated cardiac data at the time of San Antonio. I'm assured by Dr. Swain that in November there'll be another look at the composite data in terms of cardiac. So we'll be able to present that relevant to what efficacy data we have as of June of this year. And the protocol-defined threshold of a 4% increase was not reached, so all the trials stayed open. There was an improvement in not seeing cardiac dysfunction compared to the ACTH arm. For the TCH arm, there's very little difference between TCH and ACT. there was a clear and highly statistically significant excess of patients with a greater than 15% absolute LVEF decline in the ACTH arm. ACT at 0.6%, ACTH at 2.4%, and the TCH at 0.4%. Again, this is as of 12/31/04. And I think this is compelling data that we can say that this appears to be safe with regards to this particular safety concern in terms of the thing that's on everybody's mind about what we're doing, Herceptin and anthracycline. Obviously, any safety data has to be viewed in the context of efficacy data. And with the profound and stunning efficacy data we're seeing in the ACTH arm, we're going to be looking at this very carefully with regards to what we do next in terms of thinking about what would replace B31 and BCRG006 and what would the control or standard arm be. So stay tuned. Hopefully we'll have more information for you. Definitely we'll have more information for you by San Antonio. Hopefully we'll be able to interpret what it means better by San Antonio. Thanks again.
Thanks, Dr. Sleiman. You know, a clinician in practice has to make decisions every day, and we have almost 3 months until San Antonio, and yet we have these intriguing data that have come out in this press release. We have the cardiac toxicity data that was just reviewed, and Dr. Geyer is going to review the NSABP cardiac toxicity. But just at this instant, Chuck, do you think that TCH is a consideration in a non-protocol setting right now in the adjuvant setting?
Well, I think if you have a patient where anthracyclines are of concern, yes, without doubt, TCH makes a lot of sense. There are patients where you clearly would be concerned about using doxorubicin due to pre-existing heart disease, and that you get into the question of, well, wouldn't you have that same concern for trastuzumab? And my sense of it is, no, not quite to the same degree. There's going to be judgments at some point, but I do think in a patient where you have the concern, when I look at the HERA data, I feel like HERA data kind of requires me to use an anthracycline initially and then come in with sequential Herceptin. So if I have a reason where I would like to use trastuzumab with chemotherapy, then I would use TCH or possibly carbotaxol. That's where I might extrapolate that far, but I think it certainly comes into consideration.
Dr. Sleiman, what do we know about the side effects and toxicity of TCH versus AC docetaxel or paclitaxel in general?
Well, there's a lot of experience with taxanes and platinum salts based on what's been done in ovarian cancer and what's been done in lungs, so we have pretty good comfort that they can be given. They are myelotoxic. That's the significant toxicity. If you use Taxol, the significant unique toxicity to that is neurotoxicity that is less with docetaxel, but docetaxel is more myelotoxic and you have the fluid retention issues. So they both bring what they bring to the table, but I think it can be given safely, especially with growth factor, as was shown in some of the TAC data, even in elderly patient population. So I'm less concerned if you're going to treat a HER2-positive tumor, I'm less concerned with using TCH than perhaps the anthracyclines for the reasons we've talked about. But I think that based on the efficacy data, that has to definitely be looked at in that perspective.
Ed, Denny referred to Chuck Vogel's work looking at trastuzumab monotherapy in the metastatic setting. Well, of course, we don't have data on trastuzumab without chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, but sort of in a practical situation, again, older patient who you're concerned about chemotherapy, do you think it's justifiable to consider Herceptin alone without chemo?
Well, I guess that would be a consideration if you were concerned about chemotherapy across the board. Of course, I think there's a range of physicians' anticipation about what kind of toxicity older patients can get from chemotherapy. I mean, I think sometimes we undertreat older patients with chemotherapy just because of their age. I mean, I have not had difficulty giving chemotherapy to 75-year-old women who are in good health. But if you had a major concern about it and you had a HER2-positive breast cancer, I certainly think that it would be appropriate to do that.
Dr. Sleiman, what are your thoughts about Herceptin without chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting right now?
I think Herceptin as monotherapy is certainly an option if you've got patients who have coexisting medical issues that make you very concerned about chemotherapy. I absolutely agree with what was just said, that I think these chronologic cutoffs are really very arbitrary, and I think our colleagues who are doing oncology in a geriatric setting have taught us that there are performance analyses that can be done can really tell you whether or not your patient can tolerate chemotherapy. Many more patients can tolerate chemotherapy than we previously thought in this older population, especially with some of the things we have to administer along with the chemotherapy. But I think that Herceptin monotherapy is an option when you're really concerned.
Dr. Kaufman, we know that there's a lot of dose-dense AC paclitaxel being given right now in this country. It's actually the most common regimen used for node-positive patients. What about dose-dense therapy plus trastuzumab?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Neil, and I've gotten asked that quite frequently since our data were presented, and I think we have to be a little bit cautious in use of trastuzumab in the setting of dose-dense therapy. Certainly in CLGB, we did not see an increased incidence of cardiotoxicity with Q2-week AC, but we did not monitor that trial carefully. That was just based on clinical symptomatology. And in theory, it's conceivable there may be an increased incidence of cardiotoxicity with dose-dense anthracyclines, even with sequential Herceptin. So currently, I feel it's probably safest and most appropriate to not use dose-dense anthracyclines in the context of trastuzumab.